Hi guys, welcome to episode 11 of the MHP podcast. Today we'll be talking about wearable tech, newbie versus maintenance gains, and training tendons versus muscles and versus ligaments. For our first topic, it's quite large, and I know you, Jacob, you have some experience in terms of using wearable technology as well as kind of data analytics in training. And kind of reflecting this more on your roles. So you used to be more of a strength and conditioning coach over at Forge, right? Yeah.
Yes.
So how have your responsibilities kind of changed ever since going from an S&C coach to more of a sports scientist for Forge?
Yeah, so in the last 3 years, I kind of had my role was kind of 50-50 split between the strength conditioning, the off-field development, the actual coaching stuff, and then the other half was building out the sports science system. So we had kind of a bare bones, not a lot going on when I started there from a physical data analysis, load management, things like that. So it was basically 3 years of building that out, building my own system, and slowly evolving the quality to which I was kind of doing things in that department. So the change from the past 3 years to this year is I've stepped out of the strength coach role. It's allowing me to do more coaching out of Burlington, working with both athletes and adult clients, and staying very busy over there, which is nice. It's very
It's always
exciting.
good.
And yeah. And then on the sports science side, not a whole lot changes actually. So in terms of like what's new, it's more about what has been discontinued. Because
Right.
from a sports science perspective, I'm still implementing the system that I put in place the last 3 years,
Right.
and essentially monitoring every data point that comes from practice and games and everything throughout the week, and then using that to communicate with the coaching staff, making sure that players are not being underworked or overworked, because that gets into the core of kind of what the role is for. Is on one side, if certain metrics are too low, the biggest
Right.
thing we see is sprint distance. It's hard in a soccer football setting to get a lot of high speed exposure without kind of doing it in an isolated sprinting fashion. So throughout the
How
week,
come?
just because mostly because a chaotic sport like environment slows you down,
Right.
because you are as well, if you look at a typical practice model, you do a lot of stuff in smaller spaces because you're trying to overload scenarios. I think we talked about small sided games in one episode.
Yes.
So one, if the space is smaller, you don't have room to pick up speed. And even in bigger space games, you have a very technical, tactical focus where, yes, you might get the like your outside winger players getting a lot of distance, but say like positions like striker or center back positions where there's not as much linear movement, especially at center back. If you're doing a 40-yard dash, something's probably gone very, very wrong.
Exactly.
So, across the week, usually what we're seeing is there's certain players or positions that are just a little bit behind in high speed exposure. So the one half of it is trying to pull these values up so that the players are accustomed to the stressors that they're going to see in the game. And by the way, it is all relative to game numbers. We're not taking arbitrary sprint numbers and saying you have to hit this every week, and then they walk into the game and they don't see that kind of stress. We are comparing it to the actual stressors that they are going to face.
So they're very game specific.
Exactly. And then on the other side, so on one hand, it's making sure you're not doing too little. On the other side of that is watching workload to make sure that we haven't done too much too quick, because as we know, if the workload spikes too quickly or too high, then you're looking at injury risk going up alongside basically just battling more fatigue than you would need to otherwise going into that match day. So those are kind of the two big pieces of what I'm doing there with Forge.
Yeah, I don't know that you mentioned that you kind of look at measures and how they change and fluctuate. More specifically, what type of measures do you actually care about specifically?
Yeah, so the main ones that we look at are total distance covered, distance across different velocities. So we have sprint distance is anything over 75% of the player's top speed. And then what we call high intensity run distance is everything under sprint distance, but over 60%. So those are kind of the two bands we look at the most. We're looking at kind of the jogging distance and the lower intensity stuff too, as a kind of ratio of what the total distance is made up of. But mainly, we're looking at those higher speed distance metrics. And then alongside that, we're looking at top speed, because it's one thing if you're just scratching, 76, 77% of your top speed to get that distance accumulated. And it's another thing to get exposed to 90 plus percent of your top speed, because that's where you deal with implications with hamstring injury risk. If you've cruised at under 80% top speed for 1, 2, 3 weeks in a row, and then you're forced to chase a ball down at a 95, 100%, that's where you see hamstrings go, and Achilles. And there's these high speed running, especially maximal speed running, is a very unique stress. And if you're not exposed to it, things go wrong.
So
So,
that's kind of why you want to also practice in the same conditions and parameters that are re related to the game. I think we talked about it like a few episodes ago, how the best type of training you can get is sports specific training. Also, because I assume like if you do train, as you're saying, in the 70s, and then yeah, as you said, you have to chase a ball down, or you have to chase somebody down. That's, I think, probably one of the pieces that a lot of people forget about where injuries can appear, not just because somebody didn't cool down or didn't warm up properly. So that's interesting.
Yeah, so that is true. I would say the caveat to that is, like we were just saying, sometimes those game situations, it could be hard
To replicate.
to the chance of getting that top speed run is a little bit lower. So that's where getting your game specific conditioning and then also doing some high speed running, some max effort sprinting, that's going to kind of round out your conditioning model. So as far as the metrics go, total distance, distance covered across these speed zones, the top speed, and then we're also looking at a number of accelerations and decelerations, because there's a lot of joint and muscular stress that happens in those moments of pushing off to accelerate and then hitting the brakes. So those are kind of the metrics that we're looking at, not only the total in terms of how much, but also how much they're changing, and essentially what our current week looks like compared to what the player's been exposed to over the last month.
So it's a lot of comparing and contrasting.
It's a lot of math.
And kind of looking at the bigger picture, in what ways has the integration of wearable technology as well as data analytics transformed the landscape of SNC? And what are the future potential implications that you see when we talk about like athletic performance, injury prevention, as you just mentioned, as well as just coaching methodologies?
Yeah, the biggest thing, the overarching theme is trying to take away the amount of guesses that you have to make. So, for example, in the setting like what we were just talking about with the different metrics that we're looking at in practice and in games, in the soccer world, you will across your week you typically have a speed themed practice session, where what that means is it's just bigger spaces, or specifically longer spaces. So there's theoretically more room to run and pick up speed and work in these larger areas. And that's something that coaches are implementing into their weekly plan to make sure that that physical and tactical attribute is being checked off. But to just set that as the plan, implement it, and say, yeah, it looked like the guys were moving today, and say, yep, yeah, check that box and move on. Now, with the data that we're able to see, not only can you figure out if certain players are left behind, maybe the team achieved what it needed to, but you have a couple of players that finished a little too low.
Right. Some
But
outliers.
you can also just objectively analyze your practice plan. Say, hey, today was supposed to be a speed theme day. Our goal was to hit higher speeds today, and we did it. And
Unfortunately, we did it.
yeah, so like that's something that happens. And then you use that as feedback and you try to figure out, was it an issue with the way the game was structured? Was was the space too small? Was there too many players in the space? There's all these factors you can look at so that maybe next week, when you ha
Yeah,
return
you
to
can
that
adapt.
similar theme, you can make sure you're getting these exposures. So
Yeah.
that's an example of like taking away these guesses, because before it might have just been the coach's eye saying, yeah, it looked like we achieved that today.
Yeah, it looked like they were sweating, but maybe they didn't actually work as hard as they needed to be. That makes a lot of sense.
Correct. So as far as like the ways technology influences what we do, we covered a good amount of like what's covered from a sports science. It was sports science in terms of like the practice and game monitoring.
Yeah.
So with us, it's a GPS unit and a heart rate strap, and they kind of pair together, and we get all the metrics that we just talked about, and then that is influencing, where we need to supplement with a little bit more, where we need to, like I was saying, make changes to practice plans, not just to get feedback on the physical loading of a prior practice plan, but then to look ahead and say, we're a little bit low in this metric. Can we add a certain exercise or change the size of a certain drill to get the physical stimulus that we're looking for?
That
So
makes sense.
we do our best to take, obviously the coach has his technical tactical goal and focus for the session, but he cares a lot about the physical demand, and make sure we're filling all of the physical buckets as well, because fitness is a very, very big part of it. So, and the other thing too is, as the more that you can get from practice, the better. And I know there might be a lot of strength coaches that are like, maybe it's sometimes it's they want to feel important or whatever the case is, but
Right.
they want to have their practice, and then they want to do all their speed work and their conditioning and all this stuff outside of practice. But if you can check the boxes of speed and conditioning and change of direction and all these things, that's your gold standard. And then of course the things like your strength training has to be done separately, and like I mentioned, sometimes the speed stuff is a whole separate ordeal. But if we can put our egos aside and get fit from the sport, then everybody's better off for it.
Yeah, that makes a lot of sense. And kind of also maybe getting a little bit more specific with like some examples. Is there any gadgets that you use other than gadgets for practices or field? Like, is there any type of technology that you use actually inside of the gym?
Yeah, for sure. So the biggest thing that we were using is velocity-based training tools. So essentially we had the brand we had was called Enode, and it's
Okay.
just this I know at McMaster, I think they're still using push bands.
Yeah.
So that's kind of like the comparable similar kind of unit. So it's essentially this tiny little device that sticks onto the bar, and you connect it up to your iPad, and then it'll tell you how fast the bar is moving. You'll get all these fancy metrics like peak power and I mean, there's essentially endless metrics that you could get into,
Yeah,
but
you can look at like 10 different ones.
mostly people are looking at like average velocity, peak power, things like that. It can even, I think it's cool, it can even give you measurements of the range of motion, like the
Wow.
bar traveled 0.8 meters. And then you can look at how the range of motion maybe changed rep to rep, and you get all these
Now with
again.
like fatigue and exertion.
Right. So in the essence of taking away guesses, whereas maybe the eye test was like, oh yeah, all five reps look the same. And then you look at the app, it's like, oh, range of motion actually just declined across every single rep. And it might have
So
been
then
a
it's that's not as efficient then as just completing every single rep with the full range of motion.
Right, or it could give you feedback that the weight was inappropriate or whatever. But
Exactly, yes.
I think the biggest thing is looking at the velocity.
Yeah, how
It
do you guys use that?
yeah. So the one thing I like to do, because some people are big percentage-based training advocates, where it's like, we're gonna test your one rep max, and then all your programs are some percentage of that one rep max. And I'll tell you this, that is not something I've ever done in my career one time,
That's
because,
controversial.
well, because in an athletic setting, to actually test the one rep max, or even like I have done like a 3 or 5 rep max before, where then you can get a good estimate of the one rep max.
Yeah, it
And that's
takes time though, because then you also have to ensure the rest periods, and then you have to read it another day if you don't get it within that range.
Yeah, do it. Doing
Yeah.
3 to 5 rep maxes is a safer way to go about it. But again, you need to dedicate a day where the
Yeah.
whole team is going to max out on all these exercises.
Yeah. Which is like 10, 15 players.
And
It's a lot
you
of
have to
time.
allocate being able to recover from that. There's all these things. It's like, it's never felt ideal.
Yeah,
So,
that makes sense.
but the thing is, doing all that testing allows you to say, okay, we're gonna do this lift at 80% of your max. And then you get an idea of the intensity that you're working at. But with velocity-based training, you can set a velocity goal. And for example, if your velocity was set to 0.5, for
Okay.
example, that is a range where you are working at a very heavy load, like 85 plus percent. So if a player gets in into like a trap bar deadlift or something, lifts it and it moves at 0.5, then you know that was very close to their max. You're looking at that 85 plus percent. And therefore, congrats. If strength was the focus for that day, you're definitely achieving it. The caveat to that is like assuming the player moved it as fast as they could.
Right. With their best effort.
Yeah, and that's where, we talked about guesses. It's a little bit of a
Yeah,
guess,
that's a
but
little subjective, yeah.
it's also usually kind of easy to see. But that's a way w without ever testing, you can get all your different percentages and zones. And then in an athletic setting, probably what's more applicable is the faster stuff. So if you set a velocity at something like 1 meter per second, that requires the weight to come very, very low, to enable that speed to get met. And it's just as simple as like, oh, you didn't hit the 1 meter per second we were looking for today. Take weight off the bar. And there's just like no complaints. And that's the thing is when you're doing velocity work, egos get in the way. It's like, oh, but I'm used to lifting all this weight. Why are we moving these light weights around? So having that feedback just takes that out of the picture. It's like, nope, this was far too heavy. Take it off. I don't care if it felt easy. We don't want it to feel heavy. We want it to feel fast. So that's the purpose of that stuff. And back to kind of the question of was it moved as fast as possible? Having a velocity as a goal, it gets the buy-in and the motivation because they're not thinking about just, oh, I have to get this weight up to the top. They're looking at the number, the feedback, trying to get that velocity as high as possible.
Yeah, they're like, I gotta do it fast.
Yeah, so you make a
That makes sense.
you get that kind of competitive aspect to it as
Yeah.
well.
And I know you kind of mentioned, if you have a higher weight, there's more strength, and then lower, you can get it faster. Is this related to the force velocity curve?
Ah, that's right. So we talked about this not too long ago, and
Yes, yeah, we did.
we were talking about how as the force or the load that you use increases, the velocity is going to go down. And you have this whole spectrum between what's essentially very, very low velocity, high force, and then very high velocity but low external load.
Right.
And it's very important that you're getting a stimulus across the whole spectrum. You don't just want to be high force and high velocity. There's benefit to all the in-betweens as well. So
Right.
having this velocity feedback allows you to actually make sure you're checking those boxes. You can say one day you're at 0.5 in a strength-based focus. One day you're at 1.2 at meters per second at a really high velocity. And then you're also working all the in-betweens, the 0.75s and the 0.9. And if you're doing that, then you know you are surfing that force velocity curve, like we talk about.
Yeah, and it seems as if all this information is kind of really helpful when you're actually, in the gym or in the field. How about after? Does it help you at all with recovery monitoring, or is it not really useful?
There's a few things that are good. I haven't used a ton of it other than, well, I'll get into it. So the there's simple things like just a recovery kind of monitoring.
Yeah.
There's some like the Apple Watch will give you like will track sleep and tell you sleep duration and quality, things like that. There's things like the Whoop band, which get a little more advanced into giving you recovery scores and things that tie in a little bit more metrics.
Right.
But that can be very helpful, not so much in terms of like performance feedback, because we talked about like the nocebo before and how
Yep.
if your watch tells you your readiness is tanked, then you could actually perform worse because you're expecting to perform worse. So I don't really love it in that sense, but
That's interesting.
if you can use it as feedback to say, oh, when I changed my sleep habits, my recovery score went up, and then that's the kind of thing you'd want to use that for.
Okay, I see.
On the flip side, in terms of sort of fatigue measurement, we were using like a readiness score, which we were actually able to use. I don't know if the push band does it, but our Enode velocity-based training tool was able to measure jump height.
Oh, wow.
So what we would do is take the same tool we'd use for the lifting, put it on a dowel, and then do a triple jump with the sensor on the back. We were tracking the jump height as along with what's called RSI, or the reactive strength index. So that was, by the way, the reactive strength index is essentially your jump height divided by how long it took you to get off the ground. So if you jump really high but you spent a whole second loading up on the ground to push off, you're not going to get a good RSI score. So it's I always explained it like it's essentially a measure of how springy you are on that day.
That's awesome.
And because it's such an elastic test or measurement, we were using it as basically a fatigue score. So we were tracking changes in that. We were doing a test 2 days after the game and then one day before the next game. So we're doing it twice a week and looking at essentially changes in fatigue and performance like that.
Yeah, that makes a lot of sense. And I mean, I feel like, as you said, some parts of training and data can be a little bit subjective, especially because different factors can kind of go into recovery, not just how the person did that specific day. So that's definitely really interesting. Moving on to topic two, specifically talk about newbie gains versus neural adaptations. So for anybody that doesn't know, newbie gains is usually the gains that an athlete or individual is able to have in the kind of beginning stage of their training if they haven't trained before. And they usually go a little bit faster at the beginning, and then they tend to plateau. Looking specifically at various resistance training modules, how do they influence neuromuscular adaptations such as motor unit recruitment, synchronization, and firing rate? And how can coaches actually look at those adaptations to optimize strength and power in athletes, depending whether or not, they're a little bit newer into their training journey or a little bit later?
So a lot of the change that you see over the first few weeks or months of a training period, especially if it's someone that's brand new to training or spent a really long time away from it, is not actually physiological changes to the muscle. You're getting a lot of things like coordination improving, the ability to, like you said, with like the motor unit recruitment, like how hard can your nervous system fire in the specific pattern? And what you get is all these development and improvements that are made in terms of the way that you can move and the speed that you can do things before a lot of actual muscular change has been made. So it's the reason that you want to kind of take things a little bit slower in the first phases of a program, because you're not actually trying to find someone's maximal output, or because like the patterns are still being learned. You want to work at that kind of sub-maximal intensity zone, and really make sure technique is good, and allow all these things to catch up. But once that's kind of accomplished, then that's where you see that tapering off period, where the muscular development, the strength development happens a little bit slower. And that's where you see, that's kind of how you know you're in that zone where you're not hitting like 10, 20 pound bests every single week anymore. Because that just happens a lot slower. So there is this aspect that you want to pay attention to, where the soft tissues like the tendons and things like that adapt a little slower than the muscles do. So I was talking to someone about this recently, how it's important in the not necessarily those first few weeks of a cycle, but zooming out into, say, like the first 6 months, the muscles will adapt a lot quicker. And the tendinous adaptations are a little bit slower. So you could find yourself in the zone if you were training at a like a max effort, doing, leaving zero reps in the tank and squeezing out every rep. You could find yourself in a position where the muscles are able to produce more force than your tendons can handle. And that's where you could run into issues, where like typically you only see it with people in like powerlifting and bodybuilding that are really, really pushing themselves. But you could run into issues where you lift too hard that you actually pull something. Or in the extreme case, it has happened where a tendon just pops off the bone because it can't hold up. The extreme example of this is you see it with people that are on some sort of like testosterone or some sort of steroid, where it's accelerating the growth of the muscle even more than normal.
Right, but the tendon is not keeping up.
Exactly. And
That
that's
makes a lot
where
of
you're
sense.
getting more of these muscles tearing and tendons snapping and things like that, because there's this imbalance. So that's why, training hard is important, but if you are going maximal effort on every set of every exercise throughout the duration of your program, you could run into these issues. And that's the reason why you usually see recommendations of like okay, this week we're training with two reps in reserve and we're not taking it all the way to failure every time.
That makes a lot of sense, yeah.
And you can definitely, you should definitely have periods where you're pushing yourself more, testing yourself, but then it should kind of undulate where you go through slightly easier periods and then,
Right. And you go back and forth.
yes.
Yeah. And so you kind of mentioned it, muscles versus tendons. Like, what is the main differences in terms of training tendons, muscles, and ligaments? Because it seems as if they cannot all be trained in the same parameter.
So I actually had a kind of back and forth with someone a while back about this, how
Right.
you'll see isometrics being kind of branded as like tendon training. If you do your iso holds, it'll lead to a healthier tendon and things like that. Which is, by the way, good advice. Some I think we even talked about it at one point, like
Yeah, I think we did.
to do these longer iso holds can be fantastic for the health and resiliency of your tendons. But the thing that I was kind of debating about was what how much like muscular training is being had there too. Because if you do a iso hold for a long time or a heavy iso hold that's challenging, the muscle's working quite hard.
Yes.
So that can't be disputed. The thing to keep in mind is the way the anatomy works is you have a bone that connects to a tendon, which connects to a muscle in the middle, which then connects to the tendon on the other side, and then the other bone. And it's just, two bones being pulled closer together. And you can't train a tendon without stressing the muscle, and you can't train a muscle without stressing the tendon there. It's one synchronous unit. But what happens in terms of different adaptations is something like an iso hold. The reason it's talked about more in a from a tendon point of view is there's this unique thing that happens when you stand in a station, say like a split squat position, lunge position, where you're not moving. Even though nothing's changing about your position, the muscle is slowly shortening. And the tendon is slowly lengthening. I can't exactly explain the science behind it, but
I know what you're talking about.
there's this elastic component to the tendon where it'll be very, very stiff in a quick movement, but it will kind of give way
Maybe a little bit like softer, yeah.
if held in one position. And it's that specific property where when you're not moving, the tendon's able to slowly pull and lengthen that is kind of uniquely good for the tendon. But
I mean, I feel like it makes sense because then if it was always so stiff and tight, then you would never be able to relax and the muscle couldn't really move, right? That's, I think, where injuries would kind of occur.
right. And not the same because muscles are active and they're contractile. So they're able to actually pull, but there's got to be some beneficial nature to that slow lengthening that you just don't get doing fast explosive things.
And when we're talking about ligaments, where do they kind of stand in terms of training? Because I know you mentioned like isometrics for tendons, and then you mentioned different training modality kind of for muscles. Where do ligaments stand?
That's a tricky topic because they're not connected to anything contractile. Like
Exactly, they're not.
if you do a bicep curl, your bicep tendon is also receiving some stress and a stimulus. But ligaments, their job is just to hold joints in place, essentially.
Yeah, just so
And
to avoid the joints to go in the direction that they're not supposed to go.
correct. So the ligaments will you'll see adaptations happen to them, but it's not something you're necessarily going to go out of your way to target. By nature of just doing athletic things, you'll get an enhancement to the strength and resiliency of the ligaments around an area just because of those small little stressors that take place from doing a bunch of different dynamic movements. But you're not exactly going to go and do a set of something for your MCL. Like that's, not exactly a realistic thing. So it's not something too much to think about within your training, unless, there might be some implications in a rehab setting if you have like an
Exactly, like if you
MCL
just
sprain.
tore, yeah, exactly.
But because there's no contractile tissue, it's not like you can really target it and train it. So it's more about
Yeah. So
getting.
like, so what you're saying is you can't get it stronger, you can't get it weaker. You can just kind of like maintain it, and then it
If it's injured, you want to let it rest until it heals. And then from there, it's getting into those dynamic movements that that are going to stress it slowly so that it can build up its strength. Well, we seem to have had some technical issues. I've lost our host here. I'll say our goodbyes for us. Thank you, everybody, for tuning in. This was a fun one. We will be back next week with more. See you later.